It's November the 20th, 1987. Speaker meeting is Saturday Night Live. And the speakers are, the 10-minute speaker will be Marty M. And the one-hour speaker will be Allegre R.
10-minute speaker, and that's Marty.
No. Hi, I'm Marty. I'm an alcoholic. Tell you, it's probably a good thing I don't have the vaguest idea what I'm going to talk about. That way I might get a little honest. You know, it's real funny. When I first got here, I was really a mess, not only physically, but mentally and emotionally. It was real hard for me to sit in these chairs here and sit still and even attempt to listen. My mind was racing 1,000 miles a minute, telling me I didn't have to be here, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I initially came in here to give a friend of mine support, you know, but in the back of my head, I knew I was here to investigate what this was all about because I was running out of options. And I really didn't have a lot of yets left when I got here. I'd like to welcome the newcomers. You know, if you're feeling uncomfortable, you're probably in the right place. I didn't come in here looking wonderful or feeling wonderful, although I tried to keep up appearances as best I could. It's kind of hard to do when you're at about 98 pounds, your eyes are all kind of sunken in the back of your head, and you look like a raccoon from the black eyes. I was real yellow. I was real shaky. My mood swings were real erratic. I was kind of going up and down. I not only drank a lot, but I used a lot of drugs. And basically, I think it's the drugs that got me to these rooms quicker. God, my first meeting, I barely made it through without having to go to the bathroom once or twice during the meeting to do some more crank and go out to my car and drink a little more 7-7s to take the edge off. I used to keep a 2-liter 7-Up bottle in my car with a bottle of Seagram 7 in it and just a little bit of 7-Up to give it a little sweet taste. And I tell you, you know, there's times that my taste buds tell me that's okay. And my head says, yeah, go ahead, you can have one. You know, you see those commercials on TV and they dress it all up. They've got this real thin woman and this guy that she picks up on and it makes it look real good. But I'll tell you, it never looked good when I went out and did it. I'd wake up in places the next morning, and he never looked like Prince Charming the next morning, and neither did I. You know, and it took me to some real strange places that I didn't want to end up at. You know, I'd start out with all these fantasies about how nice it was going to be, and this time it was going to be different. Ha! Never. Never did it turn out different. It only got worse. I was real desperate by the time I got to these rooms. And what was real important for me was, I think this is where God came in and kind of took the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth. Because I heard this lady and I keyed into her in my first meeting that I could get out of the problem and into the solution, that there was an answer here to my drinking and using, and that if I was just willing to keep coming back, things could change. And I don't know why I really believed her. You know, she was about 300 pounds. She looked like she'd been around for a while, and she sounded real hardcore, and I could relate to that. After living on the streets for a while, that's all you key into. And she didn't seem to shuck and jive the way I used to, you know, although somehow I knew she had been there. And she talked about being honest, and that scared me. I went up and I talked to this gal after my first meeting, and I says, what's this thing really all about, you know? Is this some kind of cult or something, you know? Do you want my money in the basket? Is that it? And she asked me if I really wanted to quit. And I said, yeah, but I don't know how. You know, I can't stop sticking these needles in my arms even when I want to. I can't stop drinking even if I have to go to work or I've got a family gathering to go to. I'm blitzed before it even comes about. And I pretty much stopped showing up for life. And it got real ugly. And I was real tired of it being ugly. You know, I was tired of telling the lies. I was tired of the manipulations and all of that shit and all the games that go along with it. You know, I was just real tired. And I got in here and I felt bankrupt, you know. I had been dealing drugs, so money wasn't a problem. All the material things I had, but something was still missing. Men could tell me what I wanted to hear, and it was like, go away, you know. It didn't even work anymore. And I spent some time with this woman, and she goes, if you're willing to stick around here, come to lots of meetings, work with a sponsor, and read the big book, she goes, I bet your chances of recovery are pretty good. She goes, but you have to be willing to stick with it. And I thought, well, this kind of sounds kind of flaky, but I'll give it a shot. And she gave me a book. And she goes, when you've read it, come back and we'll talk. You know, and I had asked her to be my sponsor, and she just handed me the book and said, come back after you've read it and we'll talk. Well, I got real indignant about that. I thought, God, don't you realize how much I'm suffering? And you know, right off the bat, I had to make a choice, you know. Am I really willing to go to any lengths to quit and to stay stopped? And I was real scared, you know. Nobody ever knew me other than just real skittish surface stuff, you know. Anybody that got too close, it was like, time to go. This is getting too real. And I always felt threatened by that. And I worked with this gal for a little while, and I had a real hard time reading the book. You know, I'd read sections of it over and over and over again, and I thought the doctor's opinion was so boring. And Bill's story, I couldn't relate at all. And I got into There Is a Solution, and We Agnostics, and things started hitting home. You know, I couldn't remember a lot of what I read, but as I was reading it, I was starting to feel things inside. And that was real strange because I hadn't felt anything in a long, long time. In fact, when I first got here, I was praying to be able to feel. I was real numb and had been for quite a few years. And we got into the steps and slowly things started to change. I still had a lot of fear. I was real scared and resentful over this God thing that you guys talked about. I thought, oh, shit, here we go. You know, I had tried all kinds of different religions through different family members and different girlfriends. We'd go to churches on Sundays, and I'd see them say one thing and do another, and I'd think, well, this is kind of hokey, you know. And I got real confused. And what this gal that I was working with was telling me was, you can have your own conception of God. I thought, that's the first time I've ever heard that. She goes, take some time, be creative. Really sit down and think of what you'd like your God to be. So I made a God list. I put down what God is and what God isn't, and what I wanted in a God. And not too much of that's changed, really. I don't try to understand him anymore. I've got a loving God today, someone that's gentle with me, that understands me, that forgives me. I don't have a God that keeps score. And that's pretty nice. I've never had that before. I usually thought I was fucked from the gate. I always thought that, you know, no way could I ever, ever turn to him. I'd done too much wrong. And that's really not true. When I got into the fourth step, it was real funny. That was the first thing that I ever really attempted to do for myself, by myself, from start to finish. And I think that was a real big turning point for me. And I think I did it more out of desperation than anything else, because I was scared of going back out. And in the fifth step, my toes were curling, my palms were sweating, I was shaking, and I was scared to death this woman was going to kick me out of the house before I was even halfway through. In fact, I even had a sheet of paper with the more grosser handicaps on a separate page. And I wasn't sure if I was going to share them. But as I was doing that, this woman was sharing her own experience. And somewhere during that fifth step, we created a bond with each other, and I saw, hey, you know what? I'm really not that much different. And the honesty that came out in that, I had never been honest before in my entire life with another human being, not completely. And I felt so good walking away from that, and boy, did my perception of people and life in general change. In steps 6 and 7, you know, I really had the willingness. I wanted all of this stuff to leave, you know, and little did I know that I'd have to practice with a lot of them. And that's okay. What I've learned around here for me is that, you know, I'm not a failure. I can make mistakes and be okay with myself about that. A lot of the inside stuff of what I used to think about me has changed. And that's through the love and the understanding that I've gotten in these rooms. From hearing you people come here, get up at the podium and share your experience, strength, and hope. And not only the good things, but the hard times that you have too. I need those to relate to so that I can see I can get through those too. In the beginning, it was just a matter that you gave me hope that I could do this thing one day at a time. And that meant a lot to me. I couldn't buy that anywhere. Yet you gave it freely here. What's really nice too is that in learning how to love myself, I can also get out there and try to understand you and understand your problems and help hold your hand and walk you through some things like you did for me. And that's a real treat. That's a real treat. I feel whole today. I feel like I can go out there and do life on life's terms without feeling like I have to be encased in glass, like somebody's just going to pulverize me. And I was petrified when I got here, and I'm not like that today. It's taken a lot of practice, and it's taken being able to trust a God, being able to trust my sponsor, being able to trust the process of these steps. And that's taken some time. And there are times that I still want to doubt that. But I know from past experiences of being around here for a little while that I can trust the process. And, you know, if you're having a hard time, reach out to somebody. Don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, I used to go to my sponsor and think, God, she's going to think I'm so stupid. You know, and I'd have all these flighty ideas, you know, and I'd want to ask her all these questions, and I'd think, oh, God, she's going to kick me out. She's going to laugh. Oh, she's going to scream, da-da-da-da. She's going to fire me. And she never did. She said, you know what? I asked the same questions when I got here, and this is what you do. And she helped me to look at my options and left the choices up to me. She didn't dictate what to do. She would suggest what to do. And through her experience, that allowed me to give myself permission to attempt the same things. And it gets better every day. You know, I woke up this morning and I woke up in a growl. And what I usually do is I turn to my 24-hour book And I read the thought for the day and the meditation for the day and the prayer for the day. Then I get out my big book and I do my third step and my seventh step and my 11th step prayer and the 12 by 12. And by the time my feet hit the carpet, I'm ready for whatever God has in store for me today. You know, and most of the time I can do that pretty cheerfully. And it's all from the help of you people and the support that I've gotten in these rooms. I don't know about you, but I don't choose to live any other way. This is the biggest family I've ever had in my entire life. And this is my home group, and I really love it here. You know, there's a lot of people in my immediate family that don't understand the disease I have today. But you do. You loved me when nobody else did. You accepted me for who I was and what I was. And if that isn't a deal, thank you.
Now I'd like to introduce tonight's main speaker, and that's Allegra from San Jose.
Thanks, guys. I'm Allegra, and I'm an alcoholic. And I can't tell you when I had my first drink, because I was somewhere around 2.5 years old, because I grew up in a drinking family, and that's what we did. And when I was about 2.5, was when my folks and my rotten little kid brother, who ruined my life, and I all moved back to Seattle from Spokane, and we started going to my father's parents' house, my grandparents' house, about once a week for a cocktail party and some very uncomfortable bridge, as I recall from my parents' movements. And I would run around and dip my finger in everybody's martini and lick it off, and I got lots of approval and approbation for that, and that's what I did. And as we got older, my grandfather, when we got towards the end of the evening, would pour the end of the martini pitcher water, you know, real diluted gin, into these real pretty glasses, and we would get to drink it and be all grown up. And I liked that, and it was fun, and it felt good. And I was about 5 or 6 weeks sober when I realized that I not only did that, but I looked forward as a small child, I mean real little, to going to my grandparents' house because I could drink, because I liked the effect. It felt good. And I drank for that for a long time. And I was 90 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I realized that that was the longest period of my life that I could remember without a drink. Because even after we moved away from my grandparents' house, we would have special family dinners and those kinds of things. I mean, something came up at least once a month where we would get wine with dinner. And it was always something like Burgundy or Cabernet Sauvignon or something that was really icky. And I didn't like the way it tasted, but my father would pour us each a glass, and I would drink mine so that I could get another glass, even though I didn't like the way it tasted. And I don't remember being real aware of the effect, but the effect was there. Those family dinners were real warm and real comfortable and real nice. Those special occasions were fine, and I could sparkle, and I fit in, and, you know, it didn't matter what was going on, and I was witty, and I was good. I was a real good child. And by the time I was 15 and my parents would throw a dinner party, and I would clean up from the dinner party, and my father would come and pour me a little creme de menthe as a reward, you know, and I would drink that while I was doing the dishes, and that was just, it seemed real normal to me. Didn't everybody do that? No. And there was no real blatant falling down drunk alcoholism in my house, you know. Nobody beat anybody else up or any of that stuff. My father never lost a job, you know. I mean, he's been with his company now for 25 years or something. All over the country. And so there wasn't anything there that seemed wrong with that. And that's what I did, was I drank and I felt okay. And I do remember my first drunk, because my first drunk, I was 16 years old, and it was New Year's Eve, and I had gone out to a teenager's New Year's Eve party. And there was drinking there, and there was dope smoking and all that stuff. And I did some of that there, and then I went back to my parents' house, and there was more drinking there, and I drank a lot of champagne and got really drunk. And my father, who was also real drunk, took me out, and we walked around the block. You know, we're going to sober up here a little bit. And I remember the real dizzy spinning feeling, but more than that, I remember that the next morning, I suddenly knew what a hangover was. And it was awful. And it never occurred to me, I will never do this again. It occurred to me, I will never do that way again because I don't like the way this feels. So I won't get drunk on champagne. Well, I didn't stick to that either. But one of the things that seemed to happen for me in high school was that I could drink everybody else under the table. I had a boyfriend who was the lead guitarist with the band, and we would go to his place to practice. And he was real proud of me because I could drink Southern Comfort straight from the bottle like the guys. And I didn't get drunk, and I could drive everybody else all over the San Fernando Valley all night long, and I seemed to be able to maintain. And I did. And I didn't have enough information to know that that is one of the early symptoms of alcoholism, that we do seem to handle our alcohol better at first, that that's one of the things that's real cunning, baffling, and powerful, is that it seems to work so well, that it's such a good friend, that it makes everything okay, that it doesn't seem to be destructive in a lot of our lives right at the beginning, that it just, it's such a nice help. And so I drank, and that was cool, and I got more approval and approbation for that, you know. And when I went to high school in the late 60s, there was lots of drugs running around and stuff, and by the time I was 17, I started to try some of that, and I never really liked marijuana because it kind of made me sick and sleepy. And I never really liked acid because most of the acid that I got then was real speedy and I don't like the way it made me feel. And I drank. And alcohol was my drug of choice. Alcohol made me feel okay. And at 17 and a half, I graduated from high school just barely. And I'd been an adequate student all the way along. There was always one class that I didn't do real well in, but I'd managed to make it through. And I was real bright, and I never lived up to my potential. Worst word in the world, potential. And that made me feel bad, you know. I could never do it good enough, no matter what it was that I was doing. I could never do it perfect. Even if outside other people were telling me that I'd done a real good job, I hadn't done it good enough. I always knew that there, yeah, but you don't understand. See, what I really did, I know it looks okay, but the way I really did it, I didn't really do it right, you know? And it was miserable. And I was lonely, and I didn't know why. And there was this yappy little voice that sat on my shoulder and said, you know, if you get too close to me, if you really get to know me, but it never said what it was that you would know. And I always thought that that voice was telling me, if you really get to know me, you won't like me any better than I do. And I got here, and I found out that what that voice was saying was, if you really get to know me, you will find out that there is nobody home. I don't have the faintest idea who I am. And if I drank, I could be whoever I thought you wanted me to be. And I spent most of my life, especially growing up with alcoholism, paying a lot of attention to reading your mind and trying to decide what it was that you wanted me to be and how to placate and please and be somebody for you. And couldn't understand why I couldn't really develop strong political opinions or opinions on anything that would stick because they seemed to shift with the wind. And I didn't feel like I had any conviction behind anything that I did. And I felt real unimportant, like I didn't make a difference. And it was a mistake that I was here, and there wasn't any purpose to my life, and I was lonely. I wrote a lot of real maudlin poetry when I was a teenager, and it was borderline suicidal, and it was a lot of, oh God, what's wrong with me? And when I drank, you know, I forgot about that stuff. When I drank, there didn't seem to be anything wrong with me. I seemed to be okay when I drank. So I graduated from high school mostly because there was a 5-week school strike that year, and I had a number of teachers, and I was one of the protesters, of course. I was supporting the teachers at the union and the, all the stuff and the wonderfulness of it, and I got my first lesson in politics because one of the things that the teachers' union had told us was any students that supported the strike would be given amnesty, and that was the first thing to go in the agreement. But we didn't attend school for 5 weeks, which at that point was real good because I was right at that point where attending school was the last agenda that I had because I was barely making it through anything. And I had a number of teachers that gave me passing grades in my classes because they wanted me to have a high school diploma because I was this nice, pretty, bright kid who seemed to be all screwed up, and they didn't want me to have to go through life without a diploma. And they were reasonably certain from my behaviors and actions that I was not going to get back and do anything about it. And so I went out and I got a job instead of going to college like I was supposed to. And the job lasted about 3 weeks. And then I ran away from home, the job, I mean, everything, and hitchhiked from Los Angeles up to Orcas Island in the San Juans, where I had an aunt and an uncle who also didn't know what to do with me, and then hitchhiked back down to L.A., and then back up to Ashland, Oregon. I mean, any place not to be with me, and I kept ending up wherever I got. And ran into this real nice man who had desperately been looking for somebody to take care of all his life and who was not a problem drinker and still is not to this day. And at 17 and a half, and he was 25, I moved in with him. And 12 days past my 18th birthday, we got married because you know what? Nobody else had ever wanted to take care of me. That was the way I felt. And he never understood my drinking from the gate. And I never understood his drinking from the gate. This man has half a beer, puts it down, and forgets about it. I saw him drink hard liquor 3 times in the 13 years that we were married. And he got kind of high and buzzy and didn't like the feeling and stopped drinking. It was the weirdest damn thing I'd ever seen. And he really didn't understand the way I drank. And I saw the movie Days of Wine and Roses when I was living with that man shortly after we got married. It was on television, and I was 18 years old. And the movie, for those of you who haven't seen it, is wonderful for us. But I identified with the Lee Remick character in the movie. This woman who, in spite of the fact that her husband had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and gotten sober and was making a new start for himself, could not get drunk and enjoy it and could not get sober, and who had given up everything, her child and her husband and her whole life, to alcohol. And I knew at 18 years old that that was how I was going to end up, and there was nothing I could do about it, that it was inevitable, that everything that happened until then was just postponing that, that I was, Allegra was destined to be a bag lady somewhere, all alone, by herself, unable to get drunk and unable to get sober. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I had some alcoholism in my family, but some real funny, I mean, identified alcoholism. I have a lot of alcoholism in my family, but some people that admit it. And one of them was my mother's brother, who checks into a place up in Seattle every few years for a spin dry, comes out, stays sober for a while, or dry, and then inevitably goes out and gets drunk again. And that was what I knew. And whenever Uncle Cliff wasn't drinking, that's all that Uncle Cliff wasn't doing. And we were watching to wait for the next drink. And that's what I knew about alcoholism, that alcoholics inevitably drank again. That I had this picture in my mind of Alcoholics Anonymous, of mostly men smoking too many cigarettes, trench coats, the whole nine yards, standing around trying to keep each other sober, and old Joe would get up once a week on Wednesday nights and say, I got drunk last week, and they'd all go, oh God, and we'd try and keep him sober another week, and I knew that's what happened here. And I knew that inevitably alcoholics drank again. And at my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a man there who had been sober for 5 years longer than I had been on the planet. Thank you, God. People get sober here, and they stay sober forever, a day at a time. I mean, like, the message was real clear. I can stay sober the rest of my life here. I don't have to go out and get drunk again. And So knowing that I was going to end up being a bag lady, I went cheerfully through life. And I had a baby 6 weeks before my 19th birthday that we really wanted. She was not an accident. And she's 16 years old now, and she's beautiful. She's a real gift. And I think she's alcoholic, but that's probably because I identify lots of people as alcoholic. But the thing that's real different about her 16-year-old from my 16-year-old is that her mother stepped off the merry-go-round of alcoholism in this family. And if alcohol does become a problem for her, she knows where there is a solution. She knows where she can come. And she has a mother that lives her life sober today, to the best of my ability. That's what I do. I live sober, and I deal with life sober, and I make it through. And that is the amends that I can make that child for all those years of drinking, is that I can live my life sober as a responsible human being and just do it and just love her, that she is God's child. And I actually called Alcoholics Anonymous one afternoon probably about 12 years ago. Because for no apparent reason, one afternoon I was alone in the house. The house was clean. Everything in my life was going okay. And we had had friends over to dinner the night before. And we had a bottle of scotch in the house, which was real unusual. And I mixed it with a bunch of ginger ale. And by halfway through the afternoon, the whole bottle was gone. And I was real surprised. And I thought, oh, this is alcoholism. Drinking by myself, lots of, you know, and what do? We call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had this grouchy old man on the phone. I mean, ugh. And I wanted to know where there was a meeting. I knew that AA had meetings. So I wanted to know where there was a meeting. And that's all I wanted him to tell me was where there was a meeting. And he wanted someone to call me. And he wanted my first name and my phone number. And I didn't want to give that to him because I was afraid that whoever it was would call back when my husband was home and then I would have to explain all of this stuff and he wouldn't tell me where there was a meeting. He just wouldn't. And so he told me to call back when I was sober. So my husband came home early from work that day and the very first thing I did was I told him that I'd called AA because I had a drinking problem and I was drunk. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, that's not it, honey. It's just this, that, and the other thing, and, you know, there's just lots of stuff going on." And that was all my little alcoholic needed to hear, was one person say, "Oh, that's not it. You're not an alcoholic." So I didn't call AA again until 1984. And I just drank. That's what I did. And things got worse like they do for all of us. And my marriage got real empty. And I went into therapy, and I spent 2.5 years in therapy. And by the end of that 2.5 years... I was divorced from that man. In that 2.5 years, every time my therapist would bring up my drinking, I would say, "Oh, well, it's not my drinking. It's this other stuff that's going on. If we get all this sorted out, I won't have to drink the way I drink." And when I would bring up my drinking, she would say, "Oh, well, it's just all this stuff that we have to get straightened out, and then you'll be okay. You won't have to drink the way you drink." So we played denial games together for that period of time. And in December of 83... I was divorced, and it was a banner month. I had my 31st birthday. My divorce was final, and I spent my very first Christmas in my whole life getting up to an empty house because my daughter was with my husband. And I looked at that and thought, boy, there's something wrong with this picture. That previous October, my therapist and I had finally met in the middle, and I had told her at one of my sessions about the Thursday night before, something I was not going to tell her. I told her in the last 5 minutes of the session where I had been at Hannigan's in Los Gatos till 2 o'clock in the morning, left there drunk, driven over the hill to the beach, slept on the beach in my business suit until 5 o'clock in the morning, shook my head, got up, driven back over the hill, shaking my head to stay awake and feeling terribly hungover, showered and dressed and gone to work. And that I thought maybe alcohol was controlling me instead of me controlling the alcohol. And she said, "Allegra, what are we going to do about your alcoholism?" And I said, "Like any good alcoholic, I'm going to quit." And she said, "You may want to write this day down. And you may want to go to AA. They're a nice support group. You'll have a little trouble with their God shit and their religion, but you're a bright intellectual lady and you can handle that." And that's all this bright intellectual lady needed to hear. I did not need to go to the Salvation Army and bang a tambourine and stand on the street corners to deal with my alcoholism. I could do it by myself. And I thought that I didn't drink for about 4 or 5 weeks. And my daughter, once I was sober, filled me in on, no, Mom, you didn't drink every day, and you didn't drink as much. And I would do things like going to a bar and drinking soda until 1:30 in the morning and waiting till last call and having a drink, knowing that I couldn't buy any on the way home. And it was real lonely, and it was real miserable, and it was real frightening, and that was all that was happening in my life, was that I was trying not to drink. Nothing else was going on. And after that period of time, I took a little vacation, went up to see my aunt and uncle up on Orcas Island. And that first night there, we went to a little local island theater production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was real appropriate. And I sat with this is my father's brother, my alcoholic uncle, and he drank a quart of vodka and I drank a fifth of scotch after this not drinking period. And then I didn't drink the next day because I was so sick, so I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. And then I couldn't stop drinking after that. And then I spent Christmas by myself. And then that January, my therapist looked at me and she said, Allegra, you're all fixed. The only thing you have left is interpersonal relationships. What else is there? You know, 2.5 years, $5,000, and that was all I had left. That I didn't have any. And she said, it's time for group. So I said, fine. And the image that I got, as this real lonely drinking alcoholic who couldn't stop drinking and who knew it wasn't fixed, was that I looked like my grandmother's grandfather clock, real pretty and shiny, and all the parts inside were all twisted and they were broken beyond repair. And the one person I had left in my life told me that I was fixed, and I had to be fixed for her, and I knew I wasn't, and I was hopeless. And I turned my daughter, I gave her back to my ex-husband, because what we were doing with this little 12-year-old person was having her live at my house for a week and Dad's house for a week, and Mom was getting real unreliable. I would not show up sometimes because I was drinking. I'd become the kind of parent that I never wanted to be. I was distant from her emotionally. I didn't know what to do with this kid that I dearly loved. And nothing was working, and so I went off to group therapy. And in group therapy, there was a woman there who was young and pretty and not wrapped too tightly, and I could identify with her, and she had been clean and sober in AA for 6 months. And so when we went around group at the end of one night and said what we were going to do, I said, well, you know, I'm not social drinking. I have a problem with it, and I'm going to go to an AA meeting. And that next morning, I called AA, and I got this real gentle, nice, older woman on the phone, and I asked her for a meeting that was convenient because I was a very busy lady at the time. I was self-employed. I was an independent contractor, and I was hiding out from clients, running from clients, running from other people, I mean, just trying to kind of maintain and keep it together. So I was very busy. I mean, I had all these places I had to be hiding out, and so I couldn't get to a meeting. That was a Wednesday morning. I couldn't get to a meeting till Friday at noon, and I didn't understand why she was so concerned about me not going to a meeting that day. Well, she knew alcoholics better than I knew alcoholics, but I made it to that Friday noon meeting, and it was a step meeting. And it was a step meeting at St. Luke's in Los Gatos, the Easier Way group, and they were on the seventh step. And they were reading out of a book, a paragraph at a time, and sharing. They were on the seventh step about God and humility, and it was all my worst fears realized. It was like when I was a little kid, and I would go to the other grandparents' house and sit and listen to the Bible in Norwegian. And that was God. And the only thing that made that okay was that we got krumkaka and cookies and coffee afterwards. And at that meeting, I walked in and I sat down, and there were two people that I knew from outside the program. And I didn't hear a lot of what happened in that meeting. And at the end of the meeting, they asked if there were any volunteers to read, and I volunteered to read. And I read a paragraph, and I couldn't remember what it said, but I saw the word fear. And I said, you know, when I walked in here, I was terrified, and I don't feel so afraid anymore. And that was all I could say. And I knew I was home at my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The godchild inside of me, we were finally home, and it took her a long time to get us here. But that part of me that really wants the God consciousness knew that we were where our solution was. All of me, all those lives I was living out there, all those people that I tried to be, I was home, and I knew it. And there was a woman there at that meeting who talked about having been terminally unique when she first got here. And I had never heard the phrase before, but boy, I knew that was me. Because one of the problems I had as a teenager was that I knew loneliness and isolation and fear, and I didn't have any other emotions. Those other things like love and joy and happiness and freedom and all that kind of stuff, everybody else got those, but I was behind the door when they were passed out. And so I heard that there. And that afternoon, my office was throwing a beer and wine bus for somebody else, and I was determined to go to that. I was going to maintain the facade at any expense. I went home for a while that afternoon and had the worst obsession to drink I have ever had in my life, and I thought, this is great. I go to an AA meeting, and now all I want to do is drink. But it was not a compulsion to drink because I didn't drink. And I went to the beer and wine party at my office, and I followed directions. I was feeling real uncomfortable, and I called somebody from the meeting that day who had given me their phone number, and he said, Allegra, you're white-knuckling it. You have a big hole in your gut that the wind is rushing through, and you don't know what to do with it. Go to a meeting. So I did. And I went over to the Los Gatos History Club. It was listed in the book, and there was no meeting. And I thought, okay. And there was another couple there because the meeting had moved. And we went to another meeting. And at that other meeting, we were late, and everybody was standing around, and they were talking about sweetness and light and butterflies and happiness, and I was sitting there thinking, this is not cutting it. And then this man who is 16 years said, this is bullshit. I've been sober 16 years, and this is bullshit. And I went, right on, that's my man. I'm going to make it. It's going to be okay. And the meeting finished, and it was 9 o'clock, and I was 2 miles from my favorite bar. And I didn't know what to do with myself. It was my first, I hadn't had a drink all day, and I didn't know what to do. And I walked out the parking lot, and there was this real cute little lady, and she said, are you going out to coffee, honey? And I said, coffee? And she said, oh, yes. She said, I'm not going, but there's a group of people that go over to the pancake house over here, and she gave me directions, and I said, fine, okay, I'll go to the coffee house, you know. And I walked in real tentatively because I didn't want to break up the party. I didn't know any of these people, and I didn't want to intrude and, you know, that kind of stuff. And this group of perfect strangers sat with me my very first night sober until midnight, until they were sure that I was really and truly okay to go home by myself and not go to a bar. That one of them offered to go home with me. That one of them offered to pick me up and take me to a meeting the next morning. They circled meetings in the meeting book that I got and told me that they'd meet me there, that they would be there, that I could count on them. And I went home that night, and I got up the next day, and I went to a meeting. And I went to a lot of meetings my first weekend and didn't know what to do with myself other than to go to meetings. And at 8 days sober, I asked the woman who had said that she was terminally unique at the first meeting if she would be my sponsor. And I asked her in that very same meeting. And the love that poured out from her when I asked her to be my sponsor was incredible. It was like there was this white light surrounding us. She smiled at me. And she said, oh, yes, honey, I would love to be your sponsor. And we started working together, and I called her every day because that's what she told me to do. And at 3 weeks sober, I went into the chapel of the church and to take my third step. And we knelt down in the chapel and did the third step, and nothing happened except that I stayed sober. And I worked with her for a while. And one of the things that had happened that first night that I was sitting in the coffee shop was the same man who had said, this is bullshit, sat there across the table from me and said, don't get in no relationships. So being a good alcoholic, I did a lot of those my first year sober, and I learned a lot about Allegra, and it was wonderful. It was healthy, and it was just fine, and that's what happened for me. And I didn't drink over it either. But I had some real good sponsorship, too. I mean, this first lady told me that God was my priority and the program was my priority, that sobriety came first in my life no matter what, and that meetings were for recovery, and that I needed to go to a meeting every day. So I did. And at about 5 or 6 weeks sober, right in there, I took a Tuesday off from work because it was just all falling apart. And I walked in here not looking a whole lot different than I look now. I had real long hair, which was always in a bun and stuff, but I, you know, wore business suits and I had a new car and all that kind of stuff. So sometimes I felt like I didn't deserve to be here because I didn't have a low enough bottom. The fact was that when I went to that Friday noon meeting when I first got here, what I wanted to do the next day was go drive my car off a cliff, and I had it all set up. So see, it was okay to go to an AA meeting because I was going to go die. And I didn't. I went to AA meetings instead. And anyway, I was about 6 weeks sober and real stretched out. And I put an old sweater and jeans on, and I went to a Tuesday women's meeting. And I sat there, and I was looking at this woman across the room who just didn't look good, and she kept looking at me. And I knew her because I worked with her husband and was real surprised to see her at a meeting when I was about 9 days sober. Thought he was the alcoholic, and that was wrong. And just sat through this meeting, and it was on serenity or surrender or one of those things. And I wasn't there in a business suit. And we stood around to say the Lord's Prayer afterwards. And I burst into tears. And I didn't know why. And she came up to me after the meeting, and she asked me if I was okay. And I just fell apart. And I said, no, I'm not okay. I can't do my job. I don't know how to stay sober. I don't know what to do with my kid. My life's a mess. And, you know, I was just on and on. And she looked at me, and she smiled, and she said, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And she said, that's called surrender. And we talked for a little while, and I was feeling better, and we talked for about an hour. And at the end of that period of time, I said, but you know, it's like no matter how well I do something, no matter what it is, it's like I could do it just a little better. And I always, you know, I just always know that, you know, no matter how well I've done something. And she looked at me, and she said, oh, Allegra, that's false pride and ego. And she got in her car and drove away because she was not going to stand around with a mad alcoholic for another hour. And I didn't quite understand. I was a little pissed off. But it was false pride and ego, and it was second-guessing God, and it was not claiming my gifts. And that was the amount of information that I had at the time. And that woman became my sponsor. And I learned something about unconditional love here, because my first sponsor knew before I told her that I had another sponsor. And she let go of me with a tremendous amount of love and with a slight amount of resentment now and then. She's real human, but with a lot of love, and she is still a friend today. And I started working through the steps for real. And my first and second steps were real recognition and acceptance steps. They weren't a whole lot of action. And my sponsor told me what was happening as I was working steps, that I got a real good look at how unmanageable my life was when it was managed by me. I mean, it was patently obvious to anybody who wanted to look. I was going to go drive my car off a cliff. My business was falling apart. I was divorced. I had joint custody of my child who was living with my ex-husband because I couldn't deal with her and be a responsible adult no matter how much I loved her. Nothing was working. I was running out of money. I was trying to keep the facade up, and it was all falling apart around my ears, and it was totally and completely unmanageable. I had no way of knowing how to go about it. And that I was powerless over alcohol, and what that meant had to do with remembering a lot of times where I had insisted that this time when I drank it was going to be different, or this time when I stopped I was going to stay stopped, and that it wasn't different, that things happened when I drank, that if I take the first drink, I have no control over what will happen, that my little alcoholic mind will tell me, Allegra, you could have a glass of wine with dinner tonight, it's no big deal. And then I get to reference my uncle who helped to get me in this program, the one that I went up and drank the bottle of scotch with, who told me right before I came in here, because he had done 90 days clean and sober in AA that previous summer, who told me before I came into the program, I called him and said, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And with the vodka and the ice cubes tinkling in the glass, he told me over the phone, do it, it works. It's great stuff. You'll love sober drunks. They're the greatest people in the world. And this favorite uncle gave me permission to come here and told me that it worked and sent me a check for $100 so that I could call him if I wanted to those first 30 days sober. And he continued to drink, and I got sober. And one of the things that happened for me at 90 days sober, because I didn't know that I'd been obsessing about that, but he did 90 days, and he had a glass of wine with dinner to celebrate his sobriety. And in 10 days, he was back to a quart of vodka a day and couldn't stop. And I got to 90 days sober, sitting here in this room to go get my chip, and realized that I hadn't thought about a drink all day. and that alcohol wasn't a celebration for me, that the last thing I would have done on my 90th day was to take a drink to celebrate, and that I was different, that I wanted what you guys had here, and that I wanted sobriety more than I wanted drunkenness. And I got lots of chips at lots of meetings because it made me feel good. And it let the little kid in me go come running up here and get a chip and say, look what we did, you know. And you guys all clapped for me, and it was really wonderful. And nobody else out there understood. I went back to that group therapy group a couple of times after I came here, and then I quit because I'd found my solution here. And one of the things I tried to tell them after that first weekend that I'd been in AA was that I'd found this whole group of people that understood. I mean, I walked into that meeting at noon on Friday, and there was this whole group of people who understood what it meant. I hadn't had a drink yet today, and it was noon. Nobody else ever understood that. My ex-husband didn't understand. It was no big deal to him not to have a drink. It was a big deal to me not to have a drink. It was a big deal to you guys. You were willing to give me phone numbers. When I called this guy that night, he understood exactly what was going on with me. He understood me. And it was through being understood here that I have come to understand. That it was through being loved here that I have become the kind of person that I can love. I spent my whole life trying to be the kind of person you could love. You guys loved me back to health. And you modeled loving yourselves, taking care of yourselves. And you showed me how to do that. When I came to you with something, you said, you know what, I've been where you've been. And when I was there, this is what I did. And I listened to those people. Like my sponsor who said, this is what I did. And I listened to the people who said, I don't have an answer for you. Maybe you need to pray about it. That was one of my favorites, or write about it. One of the women I sponsor gave me a real gem the other night, because I told her, I said, yes, I said, you know, like, my friend has told me this, and you know, somebody else, my therapist and somebody else, and they've all said, one, you know, have you thought about writing about it? And she said, yes, right, I know, I get that one. When three people in a row have said exactly the same thing in the same words, that's God talking. I get the message, you know. My sponsor says it once. I got to go check it out and make sure that somebody else says it. And my second step awarenesses were a lot of acting as if there was a God who loved me, whether I really believed there was or not, and trusting that what you guys were telling me was the truth, that you couldn't all be here just to fool me, even though I was real self-centered, and that occurred to me a couple of times. And my second step was a lot of stuff like recognizing that I was about to do something that I had always done before in a given situation and didn't really want to do it, and kind of doing this sort of, I didn't know if it was a prayer or not, and I know now that it was a prayer. You know, if you're there, God, and I don't quite understand you, but help me with this. And going on about my business and realizing later that I hadn't done what I had always done in those situations. And my sponsor would tell me, Allegra, that's your second step. That is coming to believe that a power greater than Allegra can restore Allegra to sanity, to a sound mind. And I had a lot of trouble around my third step because I went over to my sponsor's one afternoon and we sat, and even though I'd done my third step with my first sponsor, she could really tell that there wasn't this real solid third step there. There wasn't a whole lot of trust there, and there wasn't a whole lot of light there. And I heard this great line, and as far as I'm concerned, that's where I was. The lights were on, there was someone home, but we were way behind in the rent. And that's about where I was. And I was real concerned about taking my third step, and I finally got around to telling her what I was concerned about, and I said, but what if I take my third step and God wants me to go to work on time every morning? And what if, and this was real hard with my real nice married Christian lady sponsor who really had what I wanted, said, what if he doesn't want me to manipulate this really cute guy into bed that I'm trying so hard to get there? And she looked at me and she giggled and she said, Allegra, that's not God. That's a parent. That's that universal parent. I love you if you get good grades. I love you if you go to work on time. God doesn't change you into anything that you're not already. that the third step was about making a decision with a great deal of dignity. There is so much dignity here that I get to come to God and say, will you please take care of me? That I didn't have that kind of dignity in my life before I got here. That God didn't create me to be a slave or an automaton or this little doobie who just goes to work on time every morning. I still don't do that. And we talked about what her God was like. And it was one of those really miraculous spring days here. It was like in May, and there were birds singing in this incredibly blue sky. And she talked about, you know, listen to the birds singing. He could have made that a horrible sound, and he didn't. It's beautiful, and it's pleasant, and it's restful, and it feels good. And what about the sound of water in a brook? And what about thunder and lightning? He had a real good time thinking those up, you know? And we went through that for 5 hours. And I talked about some of my fears. And I went home. And she went through parts of We Agnostics with me. And We Agnostics is my second step in the book. And I went home that night, and alone by myself in my room, I read We Agnostics, and I answered the questions in there. Am I willing now to believe that there is a power greater than myself? No. And I took my third step by myself, not the way the big book told me to do it, but by myself. And my sponsor had tried to tell me that it didn't communicate well in words, and it doesn't, and that there was no other description of it other than it was like being born again, and it was just knowing. And that was what it was, that I made that decision, and I went from faith to trust, that the feeling was like standing on the edge of the void and saying, okay, and stepping off and trusting. And I am different. That place in me that was always dark, where no matter how good things were in my life, there was this little black corner of misery that was real and was forever, that was always constant, was replaced. And no matter what is going on in my life, there is this little corner of light that is always okay. And sometimes it's real large and it spills over onto the people around me. And sometimes it's like an ember. But it's there, and I was changed. I was transformed. I was everything that you guys told me happened. And it was different. And it has been different since then. And I was real willing to do my fourth step, and I made a lot of false attempts, including doing things like, I'm going away for the weekend to write my fourth step, right? And picking up another sober, intimate relationship at a meeting. And so, of course, I got too busy to write my fourth step. And I learned a lot about what I liked and what I didn't like that first year sober. And it was also my first year single, because I'd been married since I was 18. And it only took me 8 months from the point where my husband and I split up for me to find the program. I didn't do real well as a drunk alone, so it was a real good thing you guys were here. And I finally got to a Sunday night at about 9 months sober, and I went to my regular meeting, and I sat there filled with panic and fear, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I ended up at a friend's house in the middle of the night, and he was either already in bed or something was going on, and I went to a phone booth and I called and his machine was on. I stood in the phone booth on El Camino Real and I thought, I just want to be an irresponsible drunk. I just want to be a lie in the gutter drunk. I don't want to have to deal with any of this stuff. That's all I want to do. You know, why can't I just do that? This is too much work. I called him again. He was there and I went over to his house. Now, one of the things that my sponsor told me when I told her about that feeling was, you can't be an irresponsible drunk. You have too much information. And I do. I have too much information. At 9 months sober, I had too much information. I was not a sit at home by the fire kind of drunk. I was a get in the car and drive around the valley, over the hill to the beach kind of drunk. And I know about my disease. And I don't get to go out and be an irresponsible drunk. It would be irresponsible for me to do that, but I don't get to not claim responsibility for it. And I sat with this man, and we talked, about my third step. And he looked at me, and he said, when I described my experience, he said, that's not the way they did it in the book. That's not the way they said it. You do it with someone else. And I thought, no, I know that this was different. I know that it was real. And he offered to do it with me again, together. But I had to ask, and it was real hard to ask, but I did. And we knelt together, and we did the third step prayer together. And I felt again like I was standing on the edge of that cliff, and nothing happened. And then he went on into a real personal prayer for himself. And I followed him with that prayer. And it was against everything I'd ever believed in. He is a born-again Christian. And it was his prayer of accepting Jesus into his heart. And I went ahead and did that because I didn't know what else to do. And I stepped off the cliff and I flew. And that is not my reality today. I have a different understanding of Christianity than that, and that's okay. It was a real necessary part of my growth to understand that feeling. And it was necessary for me to have the humility to do a third step with someone else. And a week later, I had my fourth step. And I felt like my fourth step was real inadequate. I mean, I didn't have a real heavy-duty drunk log. I hadn't killed anybody, maimed anybody, murdered anybody, raped anybody, all that kind of stuff. And I hadn't done a lot of stealing. I'd done a lot of lying. And my sponsor came over to do my fifth step with me. And I got all done with it. And I looked at her and I said, did I do it right? And she said, yes, you did it right. You cannot do it wrong. And my single greatest character defect, the one that came up, was my willingness to go out and take care of anyone and everything other than Allegra. And my sponsor told me, go to bed, take care of yourself, rest. And she left, and a friend called. And I had a friend come over because she was all strung out, and I took care of her all night. And I got a real nice, visible, this is what you do, Allegra, pay attention. And I walked around the next day. I went to work, and I felt human. For the first time in my life, I belonged on the planet. I was supposed to be here. I wasn't behind the door when stuff got passed out. I just kind of missed the information, and I was going to get it here. And I got to my sixth and seventh step, which I use a lot, and that my sixth step for me was about faith, like my second step was, about being entirely ready, looking at all this stuff the way I'd always done it, but it was standing in my way, and I knew it now. And then stepping into the seventh step with trust and giving all the stuff the way I'd always done everything in my life to God and trusting that, okay, I'm not going to do it this way anymore. You'll show me a different way to do it, I hope. And that part of the promises for me is where we intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And that it is a journey and an adventure. And that my eighth and ninth step weren't a real big deal at that point. And that I made the list and I was willing. And I made the amends. And that other amends have come up and I've been willing because I did that. I'm willing. And that I can walk down the street and I can see anybody and I can look at them in the eye and know that my side of the street is clean. I never had that. And that my life is just incredible. I met my husband here at Saturday Night Live at the Wednesday midnight meetings when I was 45 days sober. We were the two grown-ups who used to show up here in business clothes because we didn't know what to do with each other or anything else in the middle of the night. I mean, for God's sake, you know, what do? You know, I was so grateful. We only had a Wednesday midnight then. There weren't midnights the rest of the week or I'd have been dead by now of exhaustion. And I made friends with him. And he made friends with me, and I got married a little after a year sober. And you know that you can have a healthy, happy relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that you don't have to be joined at the hips like Siamese twins, and that there's a lot to life outside of the program. And the reason there is a lot to life outside of the program is because I am in the program, because there was nothing in my life when I got here. It had all gone away. And our children don't live with us. And that's okay, because it is the way it is, that you guys taught me an awful lot about reality here, that the serenity prayer that we say before the meeting is a prayer that when I ask him for it, he gives it to me. That he grants me the serenity, he grants me the courage, and he grants me the wisdom in the moment when I ask for it, that there is no question about it. That God's will for me is real simple. That he never intends for it to be mysterious or hidden. That I am the one that tries to do that. And that his will for me is to be sober and to live my life. And I am doing that. And I do it in a lot of ways, and I'm an intergroup rep, and I'm doing all those things that we get to do as we grow up sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got two real neat things at a meeting today. And they were both the same thing, but said a little differently. And one of them was, where I awaken, that's where I serve. And I woke up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And where I am planted is where I grow. And I grow here, and I come back here. And I listen to people who come back here after 30 years sober, and they come back because they tell me they get new information, and life is a journey and an adventure. And my life was over when I got here. There was no more information. I tried it all. It was all done, and I was finished. And I have just begun. And I'm real grateful to you guys because you understood me, and you gave me the gift of being able to understand you. And the relationships in my life have healed. And I have a God in my life today who loves me and loves you. And I can see God in you. And I can see light in the people here. And there was no light in my life. And my life is full of light. And it's real good today. And I just don't drink no matter what. I go to meetings no matter what. I read the book. And I sponsor the women who are the gifts in my life that I sponsor. My sponsor told me I was a gift, and I didn't understand. And she told me that she knew I didn't understand, and I understand. Because I learn more from you and from them than I could ever have learned from myself. I spent all my life learning from myself, and look where it got me. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm a real grateful alcoholic. Thanks.